General Thorne, Real 6. You were explaining about the aftermath of the fire and the Trudos.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what I learned from that was that, well, two things I was learning about myself. I had an appetite for crisis. I really liked being involved when there was a crisis and things needed to happen. Secondly, that that soldiers are quite easily shocked, and that they need a strong lead from the one time the senior commander must step into the breach with his sergeant major or whatever, regimental sergeant major, is when casualties have occurred and there's a feeling of dismay. He's got to be decisive, and he's got to be strong, and he's got to be uplifting. And if not, then the opposite happens, the malaise spreads, and you've got a problem for weeks afterwards.
What should he actually do in the way of creating a sense of uplift, then?
I think, showing immediate concern and respect for the people who've been injured, but then facing the company or the battalion into some task which occupies them immediately and gets them going. Now, for instance, in Cyprus, in just to digress forward, when I was battalion commander, a very terrible traffic accident occurred when we were in Kenya with the reconnaissance platoon. I immediately gave the reconnaissance platoon a very hard task to do, which is to build a bridge across a mountain stream, which is important to us. And the non-engineer, they said, right, that's your task. You can have a couple of engineers to brief you and to be with you to supervise, but you've now got to go and build that, and we've got to have it built within 4 days, right? And they set to. They knew that they were caring for, and I was actually visiting regularly the soldiers that had lived, and a number of them were killed. But they had a great sense of purpose, and they knew they'd been given a hard task to do, which was not just for fun, it was for real, and that we had to do it. And immediately, in a sense, they overcame their grief and their sense of despondency. But unless you encourage them to shake their shoulders and get going again by giving them something positive to do, then they'll sit and they'll brood, and they go downhill. So, you know, it's a lesson that, in a sense, instinctively I picked up from what happened with the company, I think it was D Company, because they had relatively weak leadership. The Gordons, I'm sure, were ready to go back in, ours were not.
So it's a case of providing them with a positive displacement activity.
Like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, getting on a horse immediately after you've fallen off it.
Absolutely. Tell the horse's ears being back, they've got to be pricked forward. The only way you do that is by attracting their attention to something necessary to do, and the same with men. They've got to feel that they're needed, and that activity drives away the draining effect of the depression of losing friends and of being generally in shock.
Life goes on.
Yes, has to immediately.
What were you actually doing in the Limassol area? What was your role there?
Role there was as part of the Commander Brigade to dominate the area. Very shortly after this,
you seem to put that phrase "dominate the area" in inverted commas.
Yes,
in a way.
Absolutely. We had to, in conjunction with the police, who in many ways were under our command, I think the brigade headquarters had a considerable authority there, and the police were, if not directly under command, they certainly lived extremely closely with the military, and the military had much greater strength than the police in Limassol. We were constantly out doing cordon search, of Patna village, where we caught some terrorists. They came up, they tried to escape out of the cordon and were halted and captured. We cordon search in numbers of places. We didn't have any rioting in Limassol, But we did have bomb attacks on us, we did have people wounded, and they were spasmodic. A real task was also to try and do something about Tudos, which is a great mountain range, and in which a number of sort of pretty difficult little villages stuck up in the mountains were the ideal for the terrorists to operate from. And Grievous obviously did, because he was cornered, but he got away. He was so close to being caught that at one stage he had to leave his revolver and his case and I think a jersey, and we were that close behind him.
You're saying cordon and search. Mm. Were these cordon and search operations done on the basis of deduction or random selection or hard int?
In some cases, hard intelligence. In other cases, a sensible analysis controlled by the gaining cordons. So, and to make these operations, it took time. I think the intelligence work in the island probably was not all that high quality, and the information was often accurate enough.
Well, in that sort of circumstance, normally the main source of intelligence is the civilian police.
It should have been, but of course, remember they were Turkish, mainly Turkish police, and led by these, I think actually, probably very tough but very excellent officers from elsewhere in the empire, so to speak. And they didn't have the local connections, which would have helped. And I think the special guys were riddled with informers for the other side, I think. And certainly on one occasion we searched the Kiev factory. And the Royal Naval officers had a fairly good sense of humour. Just as well, because we searched this factory up and down. And then the factory manager said, we have a small gift for you when you see the park. And the factory owner knew beforehand, because he must have done it beforehand, because he had everything absolutely frozen to the ground. He must know how many officers were coming and how many non-commissioned officers, because he had exactly the right number of little cases for the officers. Which we love about now, but by God, at the time, it told you, we were just wasting our time there. And a lot of times we succeeded. So,
So sometimes, obviously, the enemy were being tipped off before you arrived. Mm. Yeah. And Kiev, I take it, is the wine firm.
Indeed.
Mm. So you had a case of...
We had, I think the officers had 12 year brandy and the NCOs had 3 year brandy.
Ah. A very suitable distinction.
Very, exactly. Well, maybe.
When you did a cordon and search, what sort of scale are we talking about? Are you talking about cordoning and searching whole villages or...
Yes.
Parts of village or groups of buildings?
Cordoning a whole village. Mm. And then either selectively searching homes or searching a whole village.
What would the procedure be then for a cordon and search operation? What would the procedure be? How would you go about doing it?
Well, you start with your battalion A group, which would probably be around about sort of 3 in the afternoon back in camp. Depending on how far you would go. And then you would move out after dark, and it probably in the cordon and search, let's say, partner, you've got 3 companies deployed. You've got 2 companies in the cordon and a company for the search, plus the search groups, and dogs and so on. And the battalion corps is controlling it. And so you've got your cordon groups and your search groups. And you probably, in this case, I think the partner, he was sufficiently fired, so you've got actually bring food out and all that sort of thing, so exercise the quartermasters and the A echelon people. Very orderly process, as long as you've got the right maps, and preferably you'd have had a chance. all of that. Once again, one was aware in later years of how, in a sense, how gallant and decent but relatively unprofessional the National Service Infantry Battalions in the British Army were at that time, and that we had a residue of the most magnificent soldiers who'd been platoon commanders from World War II, but who, in a sense, needed to accelerate out of the war years into something which was professionally suited to a world where we were part politician, part soldiers, in a sense, at every level. We really came of age in the second half of, what am I talking about, in years 2 and 3 of the Northern Ireland situation. Prior to that, we, in my perception, we were living in the past of it, and we were benevolently arrogant. We thought we'd get by, and at the same time, we had this lovely brotherhood of men who had been through the war, and who I now see, and I'm 65, some of them remain living and are dying now. They are the most magnificent breed of people, as gentlemen, and much loved by the soldiers, never derided, but at times they weren't all that efficient when it came to sharpness in Cyprus, as far as I was concerned.
Well, they were not accustomed to dealing with this semi-political activity in the counterinsurgency.
That, and also they didn't drive themselves to levels of professionalism, which we now have. And I think that's not so much reflection on them as the realities of an all-regular army. We were a national service army, and we didn't attain the necessary levels of professionalism until we became a more professional army.
Anyway, you were saying that you'd go out. You'd have your briefing about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then you would move out. What would happen next then? Once you would you move out in motor transport?
Yes, absolutely. Unless you're very close to home, and when you've got within, say, a couple of miles at night, and obviously you'd cut your lights along the back, you'd send people ahead on foot to tell you what was going on. And you then move in. And it's wrong to say we weren't professional, but frankly, we are much, much more professional now. And so, you know, you'd basically have some form of an approach march which told you that you were going to have a reasonable chance of getting into the village, getting close to the village, without them knowing.
So it's a stealth approach.
So stealth approach, remembering that there'd be dogs, and so on. And so time spent in actually getting into position and being far enough out so you've got a chance of the dogs not being alerted was very important.
How close could you get without actually getting the dogs alerted and going off?
I'm talking about you've probably got to be 300 yards away.
Really?
And move very slowly. Mm. So you need a largish cordon. In the moment you start, because a lot of that countryside is stony.
Yes.
You start dislodging stones, and you have a long way that. And dogs in particular. Extremely alert.
What about the terrorists themselves? Did you ever come across cases where they had sentries out, or standing patrols out, or the equivalent?
No, they're all little groups of two or three or ten men. And no way. They basically melded into the villages and over in the countryside. Classic sort of stuff. Hide until you need to come out and do something and then disappear again.
Okay, so once you've got the cordon in place, now presumably that would take quite a lot of planning on the map and coordination on the ground to get all the elements of the cordon in the right location at the right time without without giving the game away. What would happen then? Would they settle down for the Hours of Darkness? Yes, exactly.
Bloody quiet. Because the odds are you'd be in position by midnight.
Yes.
Just after midnight. And then you'd have to wait for 4 or 5 hours, sometimes in pretty cold conditions, and very silent. It's only in that way that you catch it, and that's how you caught these people in partner. Because they've been very quiet, and they decided to move out from the village before the dawn.
And that was a coincidental decision on their part.
Yeah, I think we were lucky. Mm. Yeah, and we were lucky that our guys hadn't gone to sleep, because, you know, it's so often away. The one time when the guy goes to sleep is when the buggers come slipping through.
But that's always a risk with going out and laying up in ambush on a cordon, isn't it? That the soldier goes to sleep and then his snoring will alert the dogs.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Anyhow, that
so you've got the cordon out. And then the next thing that would happen, the next step, would
then
presumably...
after the dawn, when you can see what you're doing, in move... police and army searches, policemen, as I recall, with each search team, and would go through the houses as necessary and check the people, check the houses, check everything.
So, how many men would there be in a search group?
Oh, I think you're talking about a policeman and four. One of them being an NCO and probably not less than a corporal, and officers frequently to the folder, because it was a matter of actually treating people with a decent respect but also with firmness. So a team of four plus a policeman could check room by room.
Were the search teams given any special training in
But again, compared with what we do now, like we know now, rudimentary, but a lot of common sense training, you actually have, you have to go through every drawer, you have to check for loose balls, you have to, particularly in chimneys and
sounding the walls,
stone hearths and so on, you have to be particularly careful. Exactly, sounding the walls, don't assume that the animal fire is not a good place, because it's probably the best place of all, I think. So, all of that sort of stuff, yeah.
What sort of things were they looking for on the searches?
Looking for weapons, looking for explosives, looking for caches of food. Those are the three main things.
And you mentioned checking the personalities, P-checks. Were all the people on the island documented?
I can't recall. I would think highly unlikely. But maybe I'm wrong. Again, a single or something. I can't recall it being long time ago. They had ID cards, I don't think they did.
What was the role of the policeman in the search teams? Was he there?
I had to give the proper. A, be able to speak the language, B, to give the authority of the law of the land, so far as Cyprus is concerned.
Was you acting in aid of the civil power?
There was a warrant, that there was an authority to search this village.
How long would it actually take to search a house?
4, 5, 6 hours, sometimes a lot less, depending on the size of the village. And the nose of the commanding officer and the police about whether it was worth proceeding. But usually these things, it's advisable to proceed pretty thoroughly. We didn't always do that, but on the whole we did.
What sort of reaction did the locals give to these cordon and search operations?
I think common sense told them they had to just let it happen, to encourage us to leave as soon as possible, to act with, on the whole, with Christ in it. I used to get embarrassed by being offered, you know, a little liqueur and a cold drink and all that. Having been a bloody nuisance to them. You know, I've never forgotten their courtesy. And that was the quickest way of getting rid of it. I thought, how practical.
You didn't encounter resistance at any stage?
Never. Maybe I was lucky, but, you know.
And did you have a great deal of success in finding food and weapons and explosives?
No. I would say no, because there wasn't all that much around. There was a lot of effect made by a few terrorists, led by George Grievous, with great effect. And the main trouble spots were the rioting in Nicosia, which we did get involved in early on, but which was, again, pretty manageable. And the occasional terrorist operation, I mean, one of the most amusing came when, just as soon as it was occurring, the French came in force into Cyprus. And this column of French soldiers, together with an enormous great fuel lorry and those other things, was going around the ring road in Millesong, when some bloody stupid Cypriot fired on it. And the whole column stopped. The Frenchmen had been in Tunisia and gone over what, and they had a certain approach about these things. The whole column stopped, and they chased the Cypriot across the country. And they're not just hundreds of Frenchmen. And I remember the lorry stopping with the steward, you know, like that, and rocking, and outpouring them. And I thought it was super. I would have happened to be near the ring road at the time. But I thought, how typically Gaelic.
Did they catch him?
No, I don't think they did, because the guy knew what he was doing.
He knew the country, presumably.
Yeah. So he got away. But it was evidence of the Gaelic approach to when challenged, what do you do? An immediate fiery response.
Counterattack at
once. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think any sensible Cypriot was ever again fired on the French. Mm. The problem right there.
What about your chaps? Did you get shot at as well as having bombs thrown at you?
Oh, yes. But not often. Bombs, much more of a problem than shooting.
Did they tend to throw these bombs at you when you were on cordon and search operations or other occasions?
No, they're interested in the single powers of vehicles.
Ah.
Easy target, right side of the road, the glass bomb.
Presumably then you were doing vehicle patrols as well as cordon and search.
Yes, an administrative vehicle, and their idea would be an administrative vehicle.
So it would be a resupply run.
On leave, you know, traffic target.
Soft target.
Yeah, and that's exactly what certainly once, twice happened.
Now this sort of threat really does put inhibitions on recreation and so forth. What sort of things could you provide for the soldiers for recreation when they weren't operating?
There was some mighty football pitches. There was an awful cricket pitch. And the same bloody game was unbelievable. We still played. So when we were in camp, if you attend camp, we would try and find time.
For sport.
For sport, always. And we had volleyball all over the place. We had all that sort of stuff. Was available, but the answer is not very much.
Did this create trouble within the battalion at all?
We'd rather get them to the sea, the beach.
Yes.
Get the beach and have a good swim. So that we did regularly. Football was our main interest.
Now you mentioned cordon and search and dominating the area you mentioned. Would that mean that you had frequent patrols out as well? Were you trying to flood the area or saturate the area?
Yes. All the time.
Would these be primarily vehicle patrols or primarily foot patrol?
Foot. A lot of foot patrols. And a lot of vehicle patrols in vehicle and foot.
And did those patrols ever actually pick anybody up?
Round the camp, no. In Limassol, once or twice, and bombs were thrown. But that's about the limit of it. By the time we got to Nassau, the Maine, which was in February 1957, the Maine thing was trying to capture Grievous, who was creating a lot of political publicity.
Yeah.
And that meant heading for the hills, because that's why he ended up in the hills.
When you caught your suspects, the ones who you caught and who ran into your cordon, what did you do with them once you got them?
No. Straight into the police. Then people interrogated them, and then they were basically flung into jail. Into the high security jail in the casino.
So they went straight into the hands of the civil justice system. Absolutely. Effectively.
Straight from us.
And you mentioned looking for Grievous in Trudos Mountains. How was that done? Was this a pattern of searches?
Information.
Yes.
And on a sighting.
Yes.
And then the parachute regiment and the commander got up there. And we were part of that cordon, which was a very big cordon. Within which Grievous certainly was.
Yes.
There was a lot of firing going on. I think some very trigger happy soldiers around. And actually, Grievous, it's believed that Grievous got away because there was firing going on, and I think the Marines and the parachute version had mutually sort of caught in the area. And I think they were so occupied in a good old traditional competition between the two to succeed that some lead was spread around by the Grievous got away.
Well, one can imagine that if you're trying to set up a conversion moving cordon in woodland, it would be quite easy to mistake. A soldier from another formation as a target.
It's such rough, difficult country.
Yeah. What sort of lines of sight would you have when you were moving through the Trudos? How far ahead could you see a dense country?
The way to get up is to get on the tracks that are higher.
Yes.
And that's what we did. So we caught a great sweep of valley.
Yes.
In the middle of Trudos, which is where he was. And by that I'm talking about I would think about 8 miles square. Enormous area. So we had everybody we could get to do that. And then sent in these patrols to try and sift him out. And
did the searchers yield anybody? Because he was not always alone, was he? He sometimes had a group with him.
Yes. He had a group with him. And they got very, very close to him.
Did you catch anybody in that big sweep?
The whole group got away. The fire began. We don't know how the fire began. But that then really tore apart the whole operation.
Yes.
The fire was extremely dangerous.
Now you were mentioning this traditional rivalry between the Marines and the parachute regiment. How did you get on with the Marines as a regiment? How did you get on? How did the Norfolks get on?
Extremely well. Very, very happy with them. They were helpful, welcoming. They were not arrogant, which sometimes can happen. Not with them so much as, dare I say it, with the parachute regiment. Battalion commander, one of the parachute regiments came to Cyprus. And the intensity of the rivalry between my battalion and that parachute battalion was very great. And it so happened that we actually were a very, very thick battalion. So basically, we saw them off, both on the FX track and at almost everything. But that's unusual, because they are very fine soldiers, and rightly so. But they have a slight edge.